Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller, and this is what happened this week. First of all, Elon Musk offered to buy Twitter for about $41 to $43 billion. I've heard both of those numbers. I'm not really sure what it all pans out to be, but either way, a whole lot of billions. And as of this recording, he's made the offer. It's not been taken yet. It's still being considered. Not a lot of progress has been made on is that offer going to be taken up by shareholders? Who knows? But it remains to be seen. And obviously, Elon Musk has a plan. He's got something in mind. And I guess we'll just have to continue to watch and see what's happening there. Moving to South Carolina has, unfortunately, in my opinion, become the latest state to lend its support for opening the U.S. Constitution to radical revisions that could obliterate the God-given freedoms that it guarantees. What am I talking about? Convention of States. On Wednesday, Governor Henry McMaster signed into law H-3205. I spoke about this like 2 months ago. At length, if you want to know more about why I oppose a convention of states or an Article 5 convention, they're the same thing, and I talk about how they're the same thing in that podcast, I suggest listening to that, the second half of episode 42. It's from February 25th. I go into a lot more detail in that episode and talk about it some, so I'm not going to rehash it this week. All right, let's talk about D.C. The first busload of illegal immigrants were dropped off in D.C. this week. I didn't foresee any making the trip, but a busload of about 40 to 50 maybe, somewhere around in there, were actually dropped off. Jen Psaki said this when she was asked about it. Well, these are all migrants who have been processed by CBP and are free to travel. So it's nice that the state of Texas is helping them get to their final destination as they await the outcome of their immigration proceedings, and they are all on immigration proceedings. And she's right. Maybe I'm being too harsh on this thing with Texas and with Abbott, but Texas is doing all the hard work processing these folks and transporting them, probably feeding them while in transport. And what's a busload of, 40, 50, 60 people? It might have been as many as 60. I want to say it was 49, but, you know, I can't remember the exact number. It wasn't over 100, though. I know that. Look, there are thousands coming across the border every day. I don't know. Like I said, maybe I'm being too critical of Abbott, but I just don't foresee this making a bit of difference to anybody in Washington, D.C. until they're flooding the Capitol by the thousands. So a little piddly busload of 40, 50, 60 people? I mean, look, they could have dropped off 500 people and it probably would have made a whole bunch of difference in D.C. So I hope they have a bus train heading to D.C. I highly doubt it, but again, maybe I'm being too critical. We will just have to wait and see. On Tuesday morning, there was a shooting in a Brooklyn subway car that left 29 shot or otherwise injured. And I'm kind of surprised. Well, at first I wasn't surprised, and then I was surprised that it wasn't bigger news. But look, millions take the New York City subway. And if there's a mass shooting with smoke bombs released, that's a pretty scary event. And you would think that that would be running through the news ad nauseum. But by the end of the day, the memory hole of this event became very obvious and has been the case because with nearly every dramatic domestic terror attack in recent memory. The suspect in this case was an avowed Black nationalist who preached violent hate toward whites. In other words, 99.5% of Americans will never know his name. So, following that attack on Tuesday, later in the week, police arrested 62-year-old Frank James in connection with the April 12th attack that thankfully led to no fatalities because of a jam in one of his pistol magazines. So, who is Frank James? Andy Ngo, editor of The Postmillennial and author of Unmasked, which I'm about halfway through right now, found numerous posts from what appears to be his Facebook page promoting Black Lives Matter, the Black Liberation Army, Nation of Islam, and individuals who attacked whites. He posted a photo of a man who killed 5 Dallas police officers in 2016 and called on people to kill whites. Just before the April 12th shooting, he posted a video of himself shouting racist statements on a New York street. He also recently posted a video on YouTube criticizing Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson for marrying a white person. Look, social media is full of these postings from countless individuals, yet they're never censored the way that my posts about Andrew Fauci or Epstein Island or vaccines or ivermectin are censored. And I'm not saying that to whine or complain and like we all know that that's how the game is played. So that's not a surprise. My point is, the left claims without any proof that simple conservative speech is proof of white supremacy and leads to violence. Yet when we have numerous attacks from black supremacists who are promoting their hate online for all of the world to see, that never raises a flag. In other words, if James turns out to be the shooter, the Brooklyn shooting will go the way of the Waukesha massacre and the attempted assassination of a Louisville mayoral candidate, where all the suspects had a long history of promoting black supremacy, which is why it's important to rehash some of these stories. And I want to go through some of the details of them to keep them fresh in our minds. And I'm going to make a couple of points after I do. And I just want to give a shout out to Daniel Horowitz over at The Blaze, who has followed a lot of these stories and compiled a lot of this information, because a lot of this is from him. Just that he compiled it all, and I was able to access it easily because of his hard work. So I appreciate him. But the first one I want to talk about is when 6 Americans were killed and dozens others were injured when Daryl Edwards Brooks plowed through a Christmas parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin. I just mentioned it, just 2 days after the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse in neighboring Kenosha. Brooks has a paper trail of similar grievances as Frank James. Yet that event was memory-holed incredibly fast. And few Americans even know this attack occurred, much less do they understand the motivation behind it. In February, Black Lives Matter activist Quintez Brown was charged with attempted murder for stepping into the campaign headquarters of Louisville mayoral candidate Craig Greenberg and opening fire. Luckily, the bullets only grazed the candidate's clothing, and the shooter was stopped and apprehended. He came with extended magazines and clearly was coming as an assassin. But a judge let him out on $100,000 bail, which was posted by National Black Lives Matter umbrella groups. Brown's Twitter bio reads, "The total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism." And the fact that he attempted to murder a Jewish mayoral candidate should raise some eyebrows, but that is not news. Then there's the Capitol Hill attacker. Yes, the only attack on the Capitol that actually directly killed a Capitol police officer. And it's probably one that you may not have ever heard of. And that's on April 2nd, 2021. Noah Green, he rammed 2 police cars, resulting in the death of Officer William Evans and the maiming of another officer before he was shot by police when he exited the car with a knife. But in 2020, another incident, David Anderson and Francine Graham, 2 members of the Black Nationalist Black Hebrew Israelite Church, killed a police officer after holding hostages at a kosher grocery store and concocted an initial plot to bomb a Jewish community center with enough explosive material to kill people 5 football fields away. I barely remembered that one. After a few months earlier, Grafton Thomas was charged with murder close by Monsey, New York, when he allegedly charged into a Hanukkah party with a machete, killing one and injuring several others. Police later charged him with additional hate crimes after discovering Black Hebrew Israelite writing with swastikas in his possession. In general, Jews are the victims of 58% of the religiously targeted hate crimes. But few focus on who the perpetrators are. These attacks on Jews in the New York, New Jersey region are continuing. Last week, Dion Marsh, 27, allegedly told his family Jews are the real devil and warned of a bloodbath before running down 2 people and then stabbing a Jewish man in the chest in Ocean County, New Jersey. Then there's the rise of black militias, which lends credence to the concern that the supremacist mindset has already gone kinetic. Last June, 29-year-old Othel Wallace was arrested for the execution-style murder of Daytona Beach officer Jason Rayner. Police believe he was associated with the NFAC Black Militia, the New Black Panther Party, and the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, Alabama chapter. He was apprehended in DeKalb County, Georgia, and found heavily armed in a treehouse at a property allegedly associated with the Not Effin' Around Coalition, NFAC. And in an interview with NFAC's leader, John Fitzgerald Johnson, also known as Grandmaster Jay, who is currently in jail after being charged with pointing a rifle at Secret Service and Louisville Metro Police, the Atlantic described many of NFAC's adherents as follows. They joined a group that promised to take a bite out of the earth and reserve it for black people. They expected to be led by a commander who preaches radical separatism and who will swagger with an AR-15 in public and boast that his snipers can bisect a white militiaman's head from 1,000 yards away. Jay told me that he already had to vet his recruits carefully. End quote. Look, all of these stories, they should jolt us. And we should have the instinctive thought. Imagine if a white person, much less a bona fide white supremacist, had done these things. And I'm not saying the, look, you know, things aren't fair here in the United States. They treat white people so bad. They treat conservatives so bad. I'm not saying, well, look, we all know how the game is played. And it is bad, but I'm not here to complain about it. What I want to point out is that if this were happening and it was a white supremacist or a white person at all, we would have had civilization, policy, and legal changes to our entire country based on those events. And, you know, unlike the progressives and the mainstream media, I have no desire to accentuate the race of various perpetrators. I don't really care. I don't care. I don't care what their names are. I don't care what their skin color is. I just want to know if they did what they did and why. And then hold them accountable for the things that they do. If we actually deterred and locked up career violent criminals of all persuasions and had the FBI focused on known threats that aren't political persecutions, we'd stop most of these attacks. Frank James had 9 prior arrests and was on the FBI's radar, but the Bureau failed to act. They were too busy investigating ropes in garages at NASCAR. But there's something disquieting. Daniel Horowitz talked about this in his article, one of his articles about this. There is something disquieting about years worth of incessant blood libels lodged against white people, in which every cultural and governmental institution inundates people with the idea that black people are oppressed. If we are to believe that merely being white is a threat to black people, then perhaps that is fueling the rise of black nationalism, and with deadly consequences. And it doesn't take a very high IQ for us to be able to very clearly see that this is what's happening. The mainstream media is convincing black young people especially that they are being terribly oppressed by white people in the United States of America. And it is causing this rise of black nationalism. It's never a good idea to begin criminalizing speech, obviously, even hateful speech. Elon Musk is all about that right now. He's like, look, I think one of the things that's been running around the internet right now in conjunction with him wanting to buy out Twitter, or buy Twitter, is a quote that he's made about how to know if you live in a healthy society. And that's if you know you live in a healthy society when people you don't like are allowed to say things you don't like. That's when you know you live in a healthy society. We don't live there anymore. And like I said, though, we don't want the judicial system and we don't want social media platforms to begin criminalizing speech, even hateful speech. But we typically count on culture to broadly shun those who engage in that behavior. as it relates to white supremacy. We all know that any individual caught espousing those views will have the weight of the universe marshaled against him. It would not be tolerated. It would not. Even here in the South where I live, for the most part, I mean, yeah, there's pockets in the deep South and all across the country where people are racist and they might be able to get away with some sort of speech of white national, but it's the deep, dark corners of the United States of America. It is not as prevalent as the mainstream media would want you to believe. Because once they're caught, the rest of us condemn it. But there is no such deterrent that exists against black supremacy. And in fact, it is clearly encouraged by government and culture, which allows not just the vague supremacist sentiments, but even the overt calls for targeted violence against white people to exist unrestricted in the public square, which often can cross the legal boundary into criminal behavior. And that's why I wanted to go through this list that Daniel Horowitz had put out, because we see it right in front of us, that this violent criminal behavior is beginning to rise. And you know why? Because of something that the left and a lot of young people will mock you for bringing up and for saying is prevalent in our culture. Critical race theory. And as Daniel Horowitz said, it is not just a theory. It has real human consequences. All right. I was asked this week about the 5 babies that were found in DC. And so I want to cover some of that story. I did not cover it last week. It had just started to kind of hit the news last week. And I wasn't sure what all of the details were going to be. And so you're going to find, if you follow my podcast, that I am not prone to covering things that happen. The big stories like this, sometimes I'll sit on them for a little while. I find that, you know, we as a culture, we want to know, we want to know things now. We're driven by the 24-hour news cycle. We feel like we need to know everything about everything immediately. And I have found that for the most part, especially regarding a lot of these big stories, any information that comes out within the first few days is typically false or taken out of context. And it's hard for us to erase that information once the truth is discovered, or to replace that information once the truth is discovered. A lot of times we lose interest. And a lot of times the spreading of propaganda and lies is intentional. So I tend to sit on things for a little bit to find out what the truth is and let the truth kind of rise to the top. And I also don't think, for the most part, what's the point of knowing everything about something as soon as it happens? It doesn't typically change the way we live our lives between, you know, the day that it happens and 5 days later when some of the truth actually comes out. It doesn't really affect much. There are certain situations, but for the most part, it doesn't. And so that's why, for the most part, I choose to wait to find information. And so, but I was asked about this situation that happened in DC with an abortion clinic. And I did tell this listener that I probably would be covering it. And indeed, I'm going to cover it this week. But I just kind of wanted to explain a little bit about why I sometimes don't cover maybe one week what it was the really big hot story of the week. And that's because a lot of times I get this feeling that there's more information that needs to rise to the top before I can give that story the full attention that it deserves. And so this was one of those stories. And so I want to get into it a little bit, and I'll give you a little bit of background, and then I want to go through one of her actual like written statements that she gave, and we'll kind of, I'll dissect it just a tiny bit. But so pro-life activists in Washington, D.C. say they recovered bodies of 115 babies from a local abortion mill. That's the story that I'm talking about. And when we get back from the break, we're going to cover it at more detail.
This is Bob at Bob Sloan Audio Productions, the producer of this and many other podcasts.
If you or someone you know would like to learn more about how to create, record, and distribute a podcast, contact me at bobsloane.com. That's BOBSLONE.com. And we'll discuss getting your podcast on the air.
Teresa, and I've tried to say this name 100 times. Teresa Bukovinash. Bukovinak. I don't know. We're gonna go with Teresa, because I can say that one. Has a direct quote on this, and she's one of the women that found these babies. And she said, "These children's story demands to be told." She and fellow pro-lifer Lauren Hardy related their story in an interview with The New American. And Teresa and Hardy suspected, well, they were outside of an abortion clinic in Washington, D.C., and the abortionist that is there, who works at that clinic, is Dr. Cesare Santangelo. And I know I'm butchering that one. Forgive me, but me and names, man, because you can't always find out how a name is pronounced. He's the abortionist at the clinic. He regularly carries out illegal late-term abortions, according to these two women. Undercover video at Live Action News captured in 2013 a video that exposes the doctor admitting as much, although the clinic's website claims, quote, "We perform abortions from the earliest stages of pregnancy up until 26 weeks. But in that video with Live Action, this doctor, confessed to or admitted that they did late-term abortions, in the video. So he pretty much admitted it. But acting as spokesman at PAAU's press conference, thus Operation Rescue founder Randall Terry compared this abortion doctor, Dr. Santangelo, to Dr. Kermit Gosnell. And that's the Philadelphia abortionist convicted in 2013 of first-degree murder of 3 infants born alive and 21 felony counts of illegal late-term abortion, among other charges. And Terry said this. He said he's in prison for the rest of his life without parole because he was doing abortions like this. Santangelo is a criminal, and these people are heroes. And he was pointing at Hardy and Teresa. And they're facing jail. And Santangelo is a mass murderer walking free while the DOJ persecutes the innocent. But what else is new these days? Terry challenged members of the press to be honest in their coverage. She said, if it was 1942 or 1943 and a German photographer or videographer made it into Auschwitz or Dachau and took footage of what was happening in those facilities and did not show it, that photojournalist would be a collaborator with the Nazis and with the killers. And that is what has become of so much media in America today, collaborators by hiding the truth. And it is an offense against God and a treachery against these victims. Now, some among the pro-life movement criticize PAAU, and I'm going to talk about what that is in a minute, for its methods, while others people hail them as heroes. Regardless, though, Washington Surgery Clinic is the same abortion mill where, on March 25th, Teresa and Hardy saw a Curtis Bay employee loading biohazard boxes onto a truck and asked if they could take one. He let them. This is Teresa Bukovinash's press conference statement, and this is where we're going to get into some of the details of what happened. She says, "Hello, my name is Teresa Bukovinash. I'm an atheist, I'm a leftist, and I'm the founder and executive director of PAAU, the Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising." And of course, with just that name, you can begin to see why there are probably some in the pro-life community who are opposed to some of the things that they do or have done. I think that they tend to be more aggressive in their approach to shutting down abortion clinics than those of us in my circle of the pro-life movement who tend to do things more peacefully and through the legislatures. But on Friday, going back to her statement, on Friday, March 25th, Lauren Handy and I went to Washington Surgery Center to engage in anti-abortion advocacy. Upon arrival, we saw a truck labeled Curtis Bay Medical Waste Services parked outside. We approached the driver, who was about to load 2 large boxes with biohazard symbols onto his truck. We asked him if he knew what was in the boxes, and after he said no, we told him dead babies. The driver was visibly shaken. After he confirmed the boxes were from Washington Surgery, I asked him, would you get in trouble if we took one of these boxes? And he asked, what would you do with them if you took one? Lauren said, we will give them a proper burial and a funeral. The driver thought for a second and said, okay, and gestured towards the box. Lauren immediately grabbed the box off of the dolly and we brought it back to her apartment. Now, interjection, Curtis Bay denies that any of their shipments were missing on March 25th, and that was reported by the Washington Post. And they also claim that transporting fetuses is against company policy. Nevertheless, the video that Teresa and Hardy took during the incident shows the box in question labeled with both Curtis Bay Medical Waste Services, Curtis Bay Energy, and Washington Surgery Clinic identifiers. So maybe these women, you know, put those identifiers on. Maybe the whole thing is a massive setup. Some of that still remains to be seen, but it doesn't look good for Curtis Bay, in my opinion. In the presence of, going back to her testimony, in the presence of a Catholic deacon, Lauren cut open the box and the red plastic bag inside. We then proceeded to unpack the remains of 110 mostly first trimester aborted children. At the bottom of the box was a clear plastic bag with 5 more containers, one much bigger than the remaining 4. Lauren reached into the largest bucket and removed the remains of a beautiful, intact, and nearly full-term baby boy, who we named Christopher X. I think I can speak for both Lauren and I when I say this was the most devastating and soul-crushing experience of our lives. Not even years of anti-abortion advocacy could have prepared us for that moment, and it's a moment that will live on for us for all time. We continued to open the large containers and discovered 4 more babies with a range of injuries, including a fully intact girl we named Harriet, who had one eye open, an incision in the back of her neck, her brain suctioned out, and her skull crushed. 2 other late-term babies named Angel and Holly were severely dismembered. And the final baby, Phoenix, was whole and still inside the amniotic sac. A feticide is generally used during abortion procedures after 20 weeks gestation to cause an unborn baby a heart attack, which helps prevent a live birth and the excruciating pain of total dismemberment. But in 2013, Live Action captured undercover footage of abortionist Cesar Santangelo, the sole abortionist on staff for decades at Washington Surgery, admitting that he does not use feticide. Because of this admission and the advanced gestational ages of these babies and their intact condition, the likelihood that some were born alive is undeniable. Additionally, the injuries sustained by Harriet strongly imply she was the victim of a partial birth abortion. After spending nearly 3 days searching for a private pathologist to confirm these violations of federal law, a funeral mass was held at Lauren's apartment where all 115 babies were named. Shortly after, the 110 smaller children were taken to an undisclosed location for burial. They have since been buried. On March 29th, Lauren and I coordinated with attorneys to alert the D.C. homicide unit of the location of the 5 larger babies and request an investigation into their deaths. Arrangements were made for the babies to be picked up that evening, but police didn't arrive until the afternoon of the 30th, just hours after Lauren was taken into custody by the FBI in connection with a rescue 2 years prior. And that's a whole different story, but Lauren had done a protest at another abortion clinic 2 years prior to this. And I think they had sat or surrounded the facility and it had prevented folks from being able to get into the abortion clinic. And that's against the law. And so the FBI, conveniently, very timely, don't you think? Very timely, 2 years after that event happened, these women find these babies, request an investigation. It takes a day for those babies to be picked up. And it was just a few hours after she had been arrested by this one woman had been arrested by the FBI for something that had happened 2 years prior. That all seems to be questionable. So she continues on, and I'm going to skip some of the details here. But then she says, pro-life Americans will not stay silent in the face of such aggressive and barbarous violence, and we will diligently work until the American abortion industrial complex is fully disarmed and dismantled. Thank you. And that's how she ended this lineup of events here, this kind of testimony that she gave. I forget what was her statement. It was a press conference statement. Now, there are still some questions in my mind about what happened here. I think there's some arguments that can be made one way or the other. There's obviously these two women have engaged in activities that some pro-lifers would say is a little bit too far. The one woman did violate a law when she prevented people from being able to access the abortion clinic. That's all very true. We do not have enough evidence to throw this abortion doctor in jail for violating federal law. And the federal laws that they're saying he violated, of course, would be the Partial Birth Abortion Act and Born Alive Infant Protection Act. But I will say this. There are 5 babies in a morgue in D.C. whose tiny bodies show very obvious signs they were brutally murdered. And I want answers, because someone murdered those babies. Someone did. Someone did this to those babies. I mean, I don't think it was those women who have a long history of protesting abortion, but maybe it was some elaborate setup that they put together to try to, but that's one of the accusations that's been put against these women. I don't think that's what's happened here. I believe that these 5 babies came out of that abortion clinic, and that doctor is committing, because look, he's killing people. What would stop him from a partial birth abortion? What would stop him from not saving the life of a baby that he just tried to kill? I mean, literally, he just tried to kill that baby, and suddenly, because it's outside the womb, he's going to be compelled to save its life and follow the law? I don't think so. Give me a break. But whatever the case, someone did this to those babies. And I want answers, and I don't really care who it was. I'm going to refrain from saying what I want to say here. I just want them to face justice. All right. If I don't stop there, I'm going to say things I probably regret. So let's end today's show with some good news, although it's good news at the top of a bad news iceberg. So the verdicts were handed down last week for 4 men charged with conspiring to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer in 2020 and use a, quote, weapon of mass destruction in the process. A jury of 12 Americans rejected the government's case in cold fashion on Friday in a Grand Rapids courtroom. The Justice Department did not win a single conviction. 2 men walked free after 18 months in prison, and 2 men remain behind bars as prosecutors prepare to retry them after a hung jury could not agree on their guilt. That's the good news at the tip of the iceberg. What the jury did agree on, however, is the bad news iceberg. And that is that the Federal Bureau of Investigation engaged in entrapment. Defense attorneys, with the consent of Chief District Court Judge Robert Jonker, argued that the FBI attempted to induce their clients into committing the alleged kidnapping crime. I could go through a plethora of details, but defense attorney Christopher Gibbons said it was unacceptable that the federal government framed the men under the guise of thwarting a domestic terror attack. And he summed up the whole thing when he said, quote, they don't make terrorists so we can arrest them, end quote. To sum up a bunch of details, the FBI went around and found a bunch of guys on the internet that were total strangers to one another. But in another way, they were not a bunch of guys that were getting together planning a violent event or kidnapping. And then the federal government tried to get them to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer. Entrapment is what the Justice Department and FBI did. And it was not just a few rogue agents that decided to entrap these guys. After all, Key officials described the case as one of the largest domestic terrorism investigations in recent history. Undercover agents and informants operated out of multiple FBI field offices across the eastern half of the country. Sworn testimony during the trial and other court hearings confirm that the plan had the blessing of higher-ups in Washington, D.C. One FBI agent told the jury that the use of drones, airplanes, and other surveillance tools used to collect evidence against the defendants required a multi-layer approval process at the top. Richard Trask, one of the lead FBI agents on the case, who was later fired by the agency for assaulting his wife, working out of the Detroit field office, did not know when the honchos at the Justice Department approved the operation. But the American people deserve to find out who was responsible for the FBI's flagrant attempt. Not just to set up innocent men, but use such an event to interfere in a presidential election, because that's exactly what was going on when this all started happening in 2020, or when it all started to kind of come to the surface in around October, I believe, 2020. William Barr, Christopher Wray, and Gretchen Whitmer should all be thoroughly questioned. Julie Kelly at American Greatness has been following the story, and she has some phenomenal questions. She has thought through that should be put to these guys, such as Barr's office said he didn't know anything about these investigations until the week the arrests were made. Okay, sure, that could be true. But if it is, who at the main office of the Justice Department knew about the sting operation? What about John Demers, the former chief of the National Security Division that aided in the investigation and subsequent prosecution? What role did Demers have or any top official play in authorizing the deployment of costly equipment such as airplanes to coordinate the plot? Because as we know from sworn testimony, that was required. And if they knew, why did they not inform Barr? Furthermore, as Kelly questioned, did Barr inform the president what was happening when he was finally briefed on the matter? Did anyone at the White House get a heads up prior to the very public arrest of the defendants? If not, why not? Surely Barr would have known the headlines would cause a political firestorm for the president in a tight presidential race as Americans were already voting. Was Trump given advance warning? Essentially, the bottom line for me is, how far up the ladder of authority does this rot go, and how widely has the rot spread in the FBI and other justice departments? The American people deserve to know. Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee and Senator Ted Cruz pledged to investigate the FBI-concocted Whitmer operation. You know, again, just another investigation, but let's hope they actually fulfill that promise. Voters should demand nothing less.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.